Something fishy has been going on around here. I smell rats.
Can't try, but you can't avoid the destruction. All right. They say liquid means forward, and gunshot means rewind. So my selector, reload your carbine and rewind.
Three tunes together there, actually, Dave. That last one, a bit bizarre, a few stops and starts, isn't it?
Yes. Natty Natty by Reggie Lewis, better known as Alva Lewis, rhythm guitarist with the Upsetters. I think that one dates from 1972, and you can see that already Scratch is getting quite outrageous in his little mixing quirks.
Yeah, I was... When I said you were coming on the other week, I played a tune and it was, I think it was Kowth East Kank or something like that, you know.
Right.
And was that the first one where he actually did all that kind of cutting up the rhythms? And he sampled, was it a Delphonics tune or something then?
This is like, yeah, give more justice to the people. Yeah.
1972, yeah. Three rhythms and sampling a Delphonics tune.
Yeah. Which is really outrageous, yeah. and totally unheard of. And you think... It's not only that no one else in Jamaica was doing this, but nobody was doing it anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think when we look now at the way hip-hop started drawing on these kinds of techniques, and then now it's sort of permeating everything that's, you know, so-called drum and bass music and whatever else you want to call it, and yet Scratch was there in this supposedly peripheral island in Jamaica, just doing it way back then.
Sure, and that middle tune, that's a few months since I heard that one a few months ago, that Hurricanes You Can Run, but that's one tough tune, isn't it?
Indeed, and I suppose most people know it better for the dub version of it, which came on the Blackboard Jungle dub album.
Right.
The Hurricanes, interestingly enough, the lead vocal on there is Danny Clark, who was later in the Meditations. And the Hurricanes was sort of an offshoot of the Righteous Flames, which was the group that Winston Jarrett started after sort of Alton Ellis had kind of, well, broken off a partnership that he'd formed with him.
Right.
So, again, those were people that were sort of... once Scratch started his own label and had a couple of hits, he opened up a record shop on Charles Street. The Upsetter Record Shop down at 36 Charles Street.
Yeah.
And it became a real focal point for all kinds of hopefuls and up-and-coming singers.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the most notable group to end up passing through in the sort of summer of 1970 was the Wailers,
right,
who Scratch had already worked with at Studio One.
Studio One. Okay, let's just take a break there in a second, because I said before, well, let's just say again, that Dave Katz is our special guest tonight in the studio for On The Wire. And Dave's got a book coming out later this month on Payback Press via Canongate imprint. It's People Funny Boy, the first major biography, well, the first biography of Mr. Lee Scratch Perry. And I said, Dave, I flicked through this book and I'm going to really look forward to kind of sitting down and reading it. I went back to the beginning and read your introduction, and I think there's something we need to acknowledge here. Lee Perry, this should be read as like a biography of somebody who's a reggae musician, should it? I mean, it should be. I mean, we've got a problem here, aren't we, in terms of this, the way this sold? Because obviously, loads of reggae fans are going to, hopefully, loads of reggae fans are going to buy this. But you know, we ought to centre Lee Perry much more. Take him out of that kind of context, really, and say, where does he stand in the pantheon, as it were, of 20th century, you know, musical development and the real, you know, heroes and legends there.
Indeed, I think actually Adrian Sherwood put it very poignantly. I mean, he said that, you know, Scratch is obviously one of the major figures of the 20th century, the major creative and artistic figures. And I think that's really not an exaggeration.
But we do have a problem, don't we, with reggae, because there is, it's a kind of snobbery, racism or ignorance, because, you know, I mean, me, I would like mention Lee Perry in the same, like, list as, say, Duke Ellington, you know, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, whoever.
Louis Armstrong.
Whatever. A lot of serious musical critics in other genres would, you know, think you're joking, wouldn't you?
Yes, I know what you're talking about. There definitely has always been this thing that reggae is a second-rate music, and it's not important because it didn't come from America or Europe. And... I think it's quite absurd because, again, as we were saying about those last couple of tunes, I mean, when we look at the creativity that Scratch was employing and we look at the way things that he was doing in the 60s and 70s that maybe were largely unnoticed by people outside of Jamaica, yet now so many people are drawing on his techniques, trying in vain to sort of replicate what he was doing on very minimal equipment.
But it's even more than that. I mean, some of the tunes we play tonight may be regarded as like niches, you know, corners within Scratch's history. But then you've got some like tunes, some of his major tunes, and these are major artistic achievements, aren't you? If you begin to think about like the Congos album, for instance.
Indeed.
And those would stand by any major popular music, post-war popular music from the last century, for instance.
True, though, of course, at the time he had difficulty getting it released on a major
Island
label.
Ireland didn't release it, did they?
They refused to release it. But I think also as well, another way maybe that people can look at Scratch, and perhaps there might be readers out there who aren't so interested in his music.
Mm.
I think anyone who's had the pleasure of spending any time around Scratch and being in the same sort of room as Scratch will just know that he has his own way of thinking. I mean, he's endlessly creative, even just the way he might be doodling on a piece of paper. Mm. I mean, he's sort of compulsively creating all the time, even if it's not music. So I think there's something as well. Some people have made parallels. They've drawn parallels with someone like Salvador Dali. Now, I mean, maybe there are limits to how far you can stretch that kind of a parallel. Yeah. But I think there is something in there, in that the whole cosmology that Scratch evolved, and these kinds of cryptic and poetic proclamations that he's continually making. These are another...
Yeah, I think I'll give you another analogy there, because our old friend Roger Eagle, Fenny, mm-hmm. our late friend Roger Eagle, who's mentioned in quite rightly in Day's book as a kind of a Scratch devotee. I think he said, like, Tubby was Matisse, you know, Scratch was Picasso. You know, he's like that, you know.
Okay, that's exactly what I've been trying to say, so thanks for that.
Let's have another tune then. This is a DJ, and of course... a DJ who died very sadly last year. Yeah.
Yes, quite a terrible death. And a DJ that one, it has to be said that Scratch rated very highly, consistently. Mm. And the listeners out there who are great fans of King Tubby should just pay attention to this tune and picture in 1973, when Tubby had just managed to buy the mixing desk off of Dynamic Sound, the old mixing desk that was obsolete for them because they'd upgraded from 4 tracks to 8-track and were shortly to move on to 16-track. Tubbs customized this deck to give it these incredible sounds. So Lee Perry started to collaborate with Tubby on incredible sort of mixing experiments. And this is one of them for the producer Roy Cousins, an independent producer, member of the Royals.
Some cats really deal with rival war, but I say, man, if you deal with war, you got to stay far. But if you deal with violence, you shall go down in silence, be an abscondence or go over the fence. But think about this kind of thing called self-defense. Really mean with no pretense. You got to have some kind of patience, you know. You hear about this kind of thing called the monkey fashion. The monkey won't do. I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do. Don't know what to say, the monkey make me feel so blue. Oh, power to this monkey, must be some kind of body boo. Went uptown, monkey went up too. Went downtown, monkey was down there too. Standing on the corner, monkey on the corner too. Trying to light my cigarette, monkey light him too. I tell you, monkey man, got to understand this song from Saskatchewan. The kind of monkey in the jungle. Tell you the monkey got to really mongle. The monkey won't do. I don't know what to say. The monkey won't do. Went uptown, monkey went up too. Went to Meadowbrook, the monkey was there too. Went to Jackson, the monkey was there too. Went to Beverly Hills, the monkey was down there too. Went to Amber Heights, you know, the monkey was down there too. Say the monkey won't do. Went to San Diego de la Vega, the monkey was there too. People call it Spain Town, you know. Got to gather round a vino clown. Say the monkey won't do. I don't know what to say, this monkey won't. I don't know why to say this monkey wasn't capable of doing. So baby, come and try your thing before we get to ruin. It's kind of monkey dangerous and traveling around town. So brothers and sisters, you got to be ground and be no clown. He was the king of summer blues and put them down. Some of them are rats without the hide. Some of them are John Ross. Some of them are bad like Superfly. And some of them are really spies. Music hit, you gotta get high, you know. The monkey man, I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do. Look at that, the monkey got the flu. Say the monkey won't do. I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do. I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do.
monkey come down the tube. Went to Port Tennessee, monkey was there too. Went over Port Royal, monkey was there too. Went to Gunboat, monkey was there too. Went to Mobile, monkey was there to stay. But to see the monkey, Skabadoobadoobade. Bibadoobambade. Nalubadoombande. Bam chibe. Don't know what to say, the monkey won't do it, that won't tell you. Come on down with me and swing a lover, that won't tell you. Bleed on strong and I could never go on.
This is our Roy in the Wire. It's like burning fire. It's BBC Radio Lancashire, starring Steve Barker.
The lion leaps his abomination unto the Lord thy Jah. Speak the truth and speak it ever, cause it what it will. He who hide the wrong, he does the wrong thing still. You should not lie. You should not lie. Guys like Napoleon, he was a butcher. Christopher Columbus, them call him Combusus.
The first one. Is that the first one we've done tonight on the Upsetter label, is it? I think.
Could be. It's the first one from Black Ark Studio, anyway.
All right, yeah. The inimitable Black Ark Studio. Tell us a bit about this, then. I know you're just... Were you going to give us another quick story? Or I was going to ask you about Black Ark.
Ask me what you like, and I'll...
Well, I mean, what was, like, different, you know, when Perry built the Black Ark, right? What was different about that studio in terms of its build, you know, like technically what he was able to accomplish in that studio? Did he have it in his mind? Did he have it in his mind what he wanted, or...
Okay, I think the sort of genesis of the studio, or the concept behind the studio, came from being tired of having to rely on the facilities that other people controlled. So once he sort of became independent, first he was doing stuff at Whirl, and the way he would do it would be by supervising their sessions and then squeezing in one of his own right. When there was any kind of time. And then he was at Randy's, but he was paying Randy's a lot of money. So then he was working at Dynamics, but again, he was working as an in-house producer. So he'd be able to produce a whole set of tunes for them, and then they'd let him do a few of his own, which they would press up for him as like third-party licensing, as Byron Lee put it to me. And then when Channel One opened, he tried a couple things down there, but I don't know what happened. He didn't seem to work there for very long. So I think it was just, you know...
It was an economic thing, as much as anything else.
Largely economic, and also down to this control element, and, you know, not having the proper time and space to really be able to see through some of the experiments that he wanted to try.
Right.
So apparently he was searching all over town to try to find a space that he could buy to set up a studio. And the legend goes, which his ex-partner had said, and other people have confirmed, that one night he was sort of out in the yard and either fell asleep or had a vision, like you might call it a dream or a daydream, underneath this tree, which there was in their yard. There was this lignum vitae tree, which is a very particular kind of tree with this luminous green leaves. And it has at Christmas time, it emits this peculiar kind of scent. And oddly enough, there's one of those trees also in the yard at Studio One.
Yeah.
So supposedly, Scratch had some vision underneath this tree that it was right there on that spot that he should build his studio.
Right.
So he built it. And I think, you know, when you asked about what its technical specifications or what could it achieve and so on, I think the initial determining factor at the beginning was that Scratch didn't have any money. So in its early stages, it couldn't achieve very much.
Yeah.
He says to me, the first mixing desk that he bought, which was an old silver Alice board, which was designed for a radio station mixing. I mean, it wasn't a studio set at all.
Right.
He says he bought it for something like £35 on Edgware Road. Right? So he bought that, and he got this Tiak 4-track, and he didn't have much else. He had his amp, was like a Marantz. It was an amplifier for a stereo.
Right.
Yeah. And his mixing desk, it just had one single VU. It didn't, you know? So it was very, very basic. And then not only that, but Chris Lane, who was down there in the right when the studio was just setting up in late 73, he said it had like no drum booth. It just had this kind of dinky drum kit there. And it had a couple of screens to sort of make if you wanted to do some voicing. Yeah. But he didn't have any microphones. And apparently he had to borrow these mics off of Bunny Lee. And then I heard another tale from another source that maybe some of the equipment that was in there, maybe it was liberated from some other studio in London that had either closed down or was going to close down. Or I heard another tale about some microphones that were sort of borrowed that had to be returned in London again. And I think when you listen to those early Black Ark, the very, very early Black Ark stuff, it's characterized by kind of this cheap keyboard sound. And also the drum sound, like the mics, it sounds like they weren't proper drum mics. Mm. And I think he was using drum kit mics to voice and then maybe, you know, some other vocal mic for the bass drum or something.
Yeah.
But there's that very peculiar bass drum sound, very hollow. You can hear it on that last track, which was a track by Time Unlimited. And some of you may have recognized the lead vocals there of Junior Delgado, who had formed Time Unlimited. The way Junior tells it, he says, "Upsetter was the maiden voyage, you know?" Scratch heard me sing, he said, "I want to record this youth right now, right away." And he says when Time Unlimited came down to Scratch's studio, they were doing more of a kind of a soul. Yeah. They were more on a soul vibe. And Scratch said, "No, I want you to do this native singing." So he got them to change their style, make it raw, maybe more African influenced. Mm. And one of the first tracks they did was this song called African Sound. Mm. And that song that we just heard there is going to be reissued now on the third installment of Junior Delgado's More Treasures Found series. This latest installment's going to be called No Baby Lion, and it's coming on Incredible Jux, which is Junior's label. So keep your eye out for that.
Top man, Junior, and one of the most incredibly expressive voices. I mean, he's so rich, his voice, isn't it? He could have been, you're talking about soul voice, he could have been there, couldn't he?
And, indeed, and one of the great pleasures for me, not only in spending, you know, quite an inordinate amount of time around Scratch for a good couple of years and then off and on after that, but also it was being able to meet, you know, and get to know people like Junior Delgado, who there, before that Time Unlimited track, we played a little a cappella piece, which was spontaneously, you know, Junior was describing a song to me that he'd recorded for Scratch that I'd never heard of, called Lying Lips. Yeah. So when I said I'd never heard of it, he just burst into song right there. And that happened on a number of occasions for me. Mm. And really, I consider it a great honor not only to have gotten to know Scratch to some degree, but also people like Dr. Alimentado, very creative people. Again, Roy Cousins, you know, you name it, because basically everybody who's anyone in reggae music has worked with Scratch, and then all kinds of people outside of reggae have also worked with Scratch.
For sure. Let's have a word about a few of those after these next two tunes. And this is one of, I know we mentioned Roger Eagle once, but this, Roger Eagle's a big fan of Leo Graham's, and I think Scratch, Leo Graham's one of Scratch's favourite vocalists, yeah?
Indeed. They'd worked together initially when Leo led a group called The Bleachers, and that's from the late 60s, and then when The Bleachers split because of conflicts about who was going to lead it, Leo Graham's went straight to Scratch and recorded a whole set of tunes that are really just exceptional. And this one that we're going to play again, it's from the very early days of the Black Ark, Greedy Gal.
No big, she no want it. If it no long, she no want it. I said she can't satisfy. I said she can't satisfy. The more she get it, the more she want it. And she will rub it till the morning. And she will rub it till the evening. Say what a greedy piece of girl. I said she can't satisfy it. And she's a girl of any mood. And she will get you in the mood. And she will rub you till the morning. And she will dub you till the evening. The more she get it, the more she want it. Say what a greedy piece of girl. She can't satisfy.
Police and thief in the street. This is a message From the kings of kings and the lords of lords and the conquering land of the tribe of Judah and the elect of God and the light of the world and the rightful ruler. Stop brutalizing and penalizing innocent people. Brothers and sisters, stop your tribal war and live as one in unity and respect the children so that the children can respect you. Because the children are here to chant down Babylon musically. Good evening.
Versions could we play of that one, Dave? Quite a few, couldn't we?
Yeah, at least 10, I would think.
Yeah, at least, yeah. Well, my favourite shows, actually, on The Wire was when we did a Harry Moody show, Moods on the Wire, and we started off with nine same rhythm, nine rhythm version over and over and over again. Well, tell us what that was, a Clock Tower tune, yeah?
Yes, Vital Drums. Of course, the easily identifiable Curly Locks rhythm with the original vocal cut by Junior Biles.
Sorry.
Yeah, just that Scratch sort of, once the Wailers broke away from his grasp, he sort of started to concentrate on Junior Biles as the next key vocalist after Bob Marley, really.
And we should say that the track before that was Scratch on the Wire in December 1984, I think it was back in December 1984, when we were actually playing a version. And he says, give me the mic. And he did that, you know, just extemporized that, just like then, you know. And this is when he was like out of it, you know. I mean, he looked like at the end of the road, and he just did it. And it's like, that was like, you couldn't get that better rehearsed, could you, really?
Ah, but that's scratch.
Yeah.
Spontaneity has always been one of his key features again.
Yeah. It was absolutely spot on, that, wasn't it? We mentioned before we were playing those particular tunes about how Scratch has drawn people to him, and I think it's worth mentioning, and I saw this in the book, or just caught a couple of pages, where John Martin,
yes,
who's obviously a great talent, and Paul Lynn and McCartney worked with Scratch.
Yeah. Yes.
One of my favourite stories, though, and I'm glad to see it confirmed, because I'd heard this, I thought it was apocryphal, really, was David Byrne, because I'd heard that I think Tina Weymouth and Chris France were doing like Tom Tom Club or something.
That's
like
right.
That, and that was on Ireland.
That's
and,
right.
And obviously Talking Heads, and like David Byrne wanted to do an album with Scratch, but of course he wasn't on Ireland.
Well,
but I'd heard that Scratch didn't want to do it because he thought David Byrne was on Island Records, you know, and he had this vampire thing going.
Actually, Steve, it may well be apocryphal, even though it's made it in there. I'm still trying to get confirmation, because one of the things I found doing this book, I have great admiration for these Jamaican musicians, but almost every single one were very straight up and forthcoming and were completely humble.
Yeah.
Maybe one or two, you get a bit of argument about certain things. Now, the rock people, on the other hand, you know, you have to leave a message with their secretary of their manager, and then maybe if you're not promoting their most recent album, nobody's interested in having their artist that they represent appear in your book.
Yeah.
So I found it could be very, very difficult to get to some of these rock people. Now, with this Talking Heads thing, I think the source of that quote, actually, that ended up in that book, partly it came from you and partly it came from an article in the NME.
Oh,
and
there that was probably another, came from me too.
There was another article as well in Black Echoes that spoke about it. Now, but I remember when you interviewed Scratch, you asked him about
all
it
right.
on Talking Heads. Well, he never said, "I don't know David Byrne, I didn't meet him." He said, "I love those people."
Yeah.
But it's definitely true that he didn't want to work with them because they had connections with Ireland. And Tom Tom Club definitely had approached Scratch to produce their stuff
makes
backed
sense,
by
it?
Ireland.
Makes sense, doesn't it? You know,
yeah.
Hey, I'm going to ask you a question here about Scratch.
Okay.
Right, this is like University Challenge or whatever. No, Mastermind, you know. David can't answer a question. This is a tough one. Which record did Scratch request on the wire in December 84.
You're talking about the Stevie Wonder job.
Oh, I got
you?
It, didn't he?
Just called to say I love
it
you.
He did as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Blimey. But no, we played it for him as well, didn't we?
Yes, but see, this is something that, again, readers out there who might read my book will come across things like this, or listeners. You know, Scratch is a guy who can transform a tune like that.
Mm.
Or like we heard that Bee Gees, that cut of the Bee Gees tune. Well, the Bee Gees certainly didn't have "I Smell a Rat" in mind when they were doing "To Love Somebody." Yet somehow Scratch can turn these things around and make it work.
It was nice seeing the book as well. I just caught a reference to the mighty Quinn, because when Scratch stayed with us in 84, he saw this Bob Dylan book on my shelf, Bob Dylan lyrics, and I photocopied the lyrics for Mighty Quinn for him and a couple of other songs, because he liked a lot of Bob Dylan songs, you know. So he's good. He eventually did something on that tour live.
That's right. He was playing around with that in the studio a couple of times, and I think he did work it into his live set in some form or other. He also raved to me about Blowing in the Wind. The Bob Dylan song, you know, he said that's a song anyone could relate to it, because of course Scratch produced like a version by David Isaacs, another vocalist, and he'd done a couple of different cuts of it with this sort of blowing wind sound in the background, just to emphasize in case we hadn't quite gotten the message. But, you know, Scratch said to me as well, he used to just, especially when he'd go abroad fairly often. Once he had a hit in 69 with The Turn of Django, he was back and forth to London a lot. And New York, like that last track that we heard, came on Clock Tower. They overdubbed percussion and I think a new piano part in New York.
Mm.
You know, Brad Osborne was putting out some of Scratch's stuff, and Brad also had a TX 4 track, and they were doing stuff together.
Right.
But Scratch said to me, you know, I would go abroad and I would get these pop tunes, what was popular that I liked. I had my little stack of tunes, and I'd get my musicians to sort of cut over their interpretation of it, you know, based on what I told them I wanted. And then later I'd find a vocalist that could fit on the rhythm. Mm. So this is how Scratch, certainly in the early days, used to do his kind of vocal covers. You know, covers of pop songs.
Yeah, and it ran right through, didn't it? I mean, I don't know what the who the A&R or tune selection was, for instance, for a George Faith album, but that's what I mean when I was saying talking about like classic music of any description.
Yes.
I mean, George Faith is like To Be a Lover is in the top 10 Scratch albums for me of all, you know, which is like going some really, isn't it? Productions anyway.
Well, George Faith said to me in Jamaica that, you know, Scratch really handpicked the tunes that he wanted George Faith to do over. Right. And of course, again, they had a link from an earlier time to that. Again, in the early days, even before Scratch had his own studio, he was asking, hey, Earl George at the time, he said, you know, I want to record you. But I think it didn't really happen at the time. And then a bit later, when Scratch had his own studio, he recorded the first cut of To Be a Lover by Shenley Duffus, you know, first cut in a reggae style. Yeah, yeah. Then he had Earl George do it over, but he released it as George Earl. Because, you know, Scratch always wants to turn things on their head.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think once, by the time that album was done, sort of 77, Scratch had completely upgraded his equipment. Because after that song Curly Locks was a hit, and also Hurt So Good was a big hit.
Big hit in the UK.
Yeah, Scratch didn't get direct money from those because he had sublicensed it, both those tunes, to Dip, who sold them on to the major Magnet, and there was a big legal uproar about it.
Right.
But what Scratch says he did get out of that was new equipment that Dennis Harris, who used to run the Dip label, sent down from London to Jamaica, most notably this Soundcraft mixing disc. So that enabled him to have this kind of broader, wider sound with textures.
You can really tell that on To Be a Lover because it sounds like it could have been made in New York, Philadelphia or somewhere. Yeah, the quality of the recording.
In its way. Yeah. But then because it's Scratch, he's doing things like putting the keyboard through a phaser or the keyboard through a wah-wah pedal at some points, or both.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that really gave him his boost at that time was linking up with Island Records, who, you know, gave him some solid financial backing and allowed him to get new equipment as well, some new instruments for the studio.
Right. Talking about Island Records, then, well, maybe we'll play this first and then talk after. It's like the big one. It's like the connection between the Wailers, Bob Marley, and Scratch. But before we talk about it, tell us about this next tune that's on the deck there, Dave.
Yeah, well, most listeners that know Bob Marley and the Wailers will recognize this tune, but maybe not quite in this version, because this is the Roots version, so let it run.
Feeling up, feeling down, this feeling wouldn't leave me alone. Then I became a one that said, a dread, fly, not a dread and smile. In Jamaica, in Jamaica, in Jamaica, won't you dig it? In Jamaica, y'all. Even spell in the world.
A murder. Don't you know? 3-4-1, a murder. A murder. 3-4-1. A murder. Say a little prayer for the teacher. And I say me right. I saw me right as rain. I say me right, me right, me right, me right as rain. 3-4-1, a murder. So won't you say a little prayer for me, sir? Babies die, children cry, mothers cry, fathers die. Oh Lord, say a little prayer for the people in the ghetto. I want you say a little prayer for the people in the garden.
Let them say
that's
a little prayer.
That's all I could say.
Everybody say, come on, say a little prayer. No suffering. For the man of fire, for the woman,
babies cry in the jungle, in the jungle,
for the children.
I said, for the babies in the jungle.
little pride. That's all I could. That's all I could say.
It's got to be said, Dave, that's outrageous.
Yeah, it's a bit out there. This is Scratch sort of building up to his forte, really. Mm. Like I say, once he had some better equipment at his disposal, you know, he could let out those ideas that are crowding up his head, he could let them out a bit more.
There's only one more outrageous thing than that I know of, like, that I've heard, you know, which is the Wong Chu and the dub of Keep On Moving, you know, which is as far,
yes,
like, that's, as far as it goes, isn't it, really?
That's about as over the top as it gets. I think the rhythm itself restarts about three times.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it starts out at the beginning, you don't think it's any different from the original
that's
version.
Right.
Until a few odd sort of honking sounds come in.
Yeah, we'll have the full version of that in next week's show, and maybe by which time we'll have the finished version of your book in as well.
Yeah, well, let's hope so.
Whilst we're on Marley, of course, we played the Smiley, yeah?
Smile Jamaica,
and
Black Ark version.
Yeah, and we were playing that earlier on in the evening, and I said to you, didn't I? Scratch was a much bigger influence on Marley than he's immediately appears in, like, the history so far. You just have to listen to that track, don't you, really? Marley's vocal on that track and understand.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And this is something I came up on time and time again. Countless other artists who were around at that time all testified that really... Bob Marley's vocal style, it was just never the same after he'd been working with Scratch. It had a concrete change that really prepared him for the international stardom that he then enjoyed. Mm. And I think you're right in that some of the other accounts have sort of downplayed this element.
Well, what they do, the accounts, is say Joe Higgs vocal tutor, Perry studio tutor in terms of radio tunes, and that's it, and it's all, but it's not like that, is it, really?
Well, I'll give you one of the most concrete examples. I came up was I was interviewing Tabby from the Diamonds, lead singer of the Mighty Diamonds. He said to me that, again, the Diamonds were down at Black Ark Studio in the very early days of the Black Ark, and they sing back up on Hurt So Good. He says to me one day he went down to that studio and he heard this track playing. And he heard this voice singing, and he went, "Oh wow, you know, that must be the new Lee Perry track. Wow, listen to that." But when he went in there, you know, it was like some Bob Marley track.
Yeah.
And he said he just realized that this vocal style came directly from Scratch. Mm. Also, Jimmy Riley, you know, well-known singer and associate of Scratch and Marley from that time, he said again directly, you know, Scratch picked up his whole sort of vocal inflection, just he got it from Scratch.
Yeah.
And if we think again about songs like Dreadlocks in Moonlight, well, that song was written for Bob Marley, but apparently Chris Blackwell heard, you know, Scratch's demo version, and he said, "Hey, that's a great track, I'll just put it out as it is."
Yeah.
So I think, again, the way that this link was so special, and the way that sort of Scratch really shaped Bob's style, it's borne out by the fact that even though, you know, once Marley had his concrete deal with Island Records and didn't need to be working with sort of little Jamaican producers anymore, he returned to Scratch's side any time he had a serious tune to cut. Mm. Like, you look at Ja Live. You know, I mean, he could have cut Ja Live on his own. He could have cut it anywhere he wanted with whoever he wanted. And, of course, he turned to Scratch and said, "Hey, Scratch, come and produce this tune." Mm. And same right the way through, you know, Smile Jamaica, apparently, what Marcia Griffiths was saying to me was that they were asked to, Bob Marley was asked to write that song by the Jamaica Tourist Board to help give the island's profile a boost. And that's the first time I've ever heard that. So I don't know if it's true, but that's what she says. She said to me, you know, that Scratch, they recorded the version at Harry J that everyone knows, but Scratch, you know, he wanted a more rootsy version. Sangi Davis, lead singer for The Gatherers, said as well. Scratch came to him and he said, "Yeah, I've done my tune, Smile Jamaica, but It's not hard enough. It's not, you know, it's not enough for the people. So I want to take it to scratch. Come on, let's go. And they went down to Black Ark and they cut that version. And, you know, Marley kept working with Scratch right close up until when he passed away. Mm. You know, the some of the most incredible material, again, which has recently been bootlegged, those phenomenal tracks, Who Caught the Game and I Know a Place.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, so I think, again, this link, it's just very, very important. And really, Scratch got the best out of Bob, and Bob drew the best out of Scratch.
So we can read about this in the book as well?
Yes, in detail.
Good enough. On with the tunes then. This next one, does this one go back in time, or is this...
Yeah, it's a little bit, this is like 75.
Right.
And it's sort of late 75, so you can notice he's just starting to bring in the Echoplex, this kind of tape delay on the vocal.
Which is a great machine, wasn't it, the Echoplex? Because it's plastic, isn't it, basically? As I recall, it's a kind of plastic thing. It looks like it's just arrived from space, as I recall. Is that right?
That's one way of putting it.
How the wind blows in the tree, that's the way we should be free. Now the secret of love you can see, and what is to be, it must be. So live and let's live in our own way. You can't hide from yourself, oh no. But freedom is every man's dream, yeah. The pressures around day to day, waiting to get in our way, yeah. You're searching to find peace of mind, but the greatest thing is to know.
What was that then? I missed that.
Freedom by the Interns.
Oh, Freedom by the Interns on... what do you say, Fanny?
Muffin State.
I should play that Mrs. Cakehead thingy, isn't it? The Mrs. Cakehead jingle. I'll do that in a minute anyway. I think Dave will like that. Freedom from the Interns, followed by the Dub.
Yes, and the Interns, of course, better known as the Viceroys, who had worked previously with Scratch in about 71. They did a song called River to Cross with Scratch. And that particular tune, Freedom, was actually not produced by Scratch. It was produced by Lloyd A. Campbell, a small independent producer who had links with people like Scratch and Niney.
Yeah, who did some, like, Root tunes, I think, didn't he, as well, in the early days, didn't he?
Maybe, unless you're mixing them up with Lloyd Terrell, probably.
No, I don't think so. No.
If you say so.
what have we got up next, Dave? Because we've got about... Let's see what time we've got. About 12 minutes to go on the show.
Okay, we're running out of time.
We've got a few tunes, haven't we, really?
Yeah. Indeed. Anyway, next up we've got Ronnie Davis, You Are the Fool. Again, it's not... technically not produced by Scratch, but it was recorded at his studio for Ronnie Davis and his associate Pat Scabba.
Look at yourself, tell me who you think you are. You're running from here to there, shooting people like a movie star. Didn't you know that it all coming back to you? Didn't you know, the show is gonna end soon? You're the fool, yes, you are the fool.
We'll be right back.
Black Ark Studio, its original basis on the righteousness of fulfillments of prophecy, the Ark of the Covenant, which Noah, who gained blessing and favor of the Lord to produce the mind of people who are clean, to produce and portray life, positive dreams, to make it a reality. So the reason to call my studio the Black Ark, it's mean originally the Ark of the Covenant, in not interpreting but performing the works of the Holy Trinity of love that ferment over our head above.
Dave Katz, author of People Funny Boy, going out on Payback Press. Thank you for visiting us tonight on The Wire.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
In the steps of Lee Scratch Perry. Where Lee Scratch Perry stood before, you have now stood. Seriously, Dave, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you coming and telling us about your experiences with Scratch, what you've learnt over the years, and play some of these great tunes as well. Is this just part one, really? Can we say?
Yeah, well, I think definitely a part two is in order, since we've barely even touched the top of the pile. Yes. Well,
I thought you were going to say scratch the surface there for a minute.
For want of a better word or term.
Which last tunes we've played? This one, I don't know, is the scratch tune? Yeah,
yeah, this is Paul Bogle by the Cimarrons, and it's actually one of two tunes that Cimarrons recorded in Jamaica at the Black Ark after their cover version of Marley's Talking Blues that they recorded in England became a big hit in Jamaica.
It was a great cover version, actually.
Indeed. Yeah. So I think it was Tommy Cohen, actually, who brought them down to Jamaica to do some gigs, including one at the Playboy Club. And I think he also brought them down to do those two tunes with Scratch when they were working on the On the Rock album.
Nice job. And the one before that was one I wouldn't have believed. I wouldn't have picked up at a record fair or something like that. Fudge Brothers and Super 8, you know.
Yes, Fudge Brother and Super 8 Corporation, as they're named on another release that was also apparently recorded at the Black Ark. Who knows who they are exactly? I couldn't tell you.
And who knows where they've gone?
I think they may have gone to Canada. Some of their records seem to have been issued in Canada.
Somebody's got to go there, Dave, as I say. Thanks so much again for the show, and maybe you'll revisit when the books are roaring success over the next few months, and maybe you'll still talk to us and bring a few more tunes for us.
It'll be my pleasure again.
Dave Katz, thanks a lot, and thanks to you for listening. We'll see you next week for another edition of On the Wire.
Hartman, what do you think the English need in this time of critical man?
Need a leader, Rasta.
We need a leader. England need a leader. We need a leader. England need a leader. With this a freezer. England need a leader.
Paul Bogle.
England need a leader like Paul Bogle. Bogle. Him went over the hill and.